Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the We Like to Discuss Marijuana show. One of us, me, attended the Rowan Fiscal Court meeting shortly before we recorded this, and we got into an intense discussion of the benefits and the dangers of medical marijuana there, and we thought we would give you some excerpts from that discussion a little bit of a few facts on marijuana as best we can discern them. Now, I can't do this by myself. Of course, that would be impossible, so I brought in some additional help into the studio from the University of Kentucky, assistant professor in their physician assistant program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And executive director of network and infrastructure, Rick Phillips. And Rick will materially contribute to the show by discussing our web presence.
You're not even going to discuss the kind of day we've had?
Rick's had a day.
Well, but...
I mean, the thing is, what is it? Networking and infrastructure.
Yeah,
he is just the director of the university networking and infrastructure, and apparently his own personal phone has had difficulty today.
It has. But when was the last time you were on a university campus and you didn't complain about their Wi-Fi? Has there ever been a time?
Listen, you know where I live, and you know how I access the internet.
That's true. Your expectations are considerably lower than most.
It's absolutely glorious to me. Web pages actually appear when you click on them, and it's incredible.
Yeah, 3 whole meg, you're happy.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, take those 3 meg, go to www.wmky.org, and that you will find is the Morehead State Public Radio website. And Health Matters has a presence there. We use that presence to distribute the audio of the show. You can get the most recent shows are there. There's a link to the MP3 file so you can go and listen to them. There's a summary so you can kind of figure out what's in the show, provided Tony remembered what he actually said during the show and it's synced up with the summary. No guarantees, but hey, have fun exploring. After that, it's time to start the two-way interaction. That happens on Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Heart Attacks in Women, and courtesy to Hank Williams, your beating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your beating heart will tell on you. That's right. According to Hank Williams, your beating heart will tell on you. These are the symptoms of heart attacks.
You sounded a little bit more like Willie Nelson than Hank Williams, but okay.
Well, in honor of this show, it's a crossover type show. I'll take it. At any rate, this is an article published in Circulation, February 19th, 2018, Sex Differences in Presentation and Perception of Symptoms Among Young Patients with Heart Attacks with Myocardial Infarctions. They looked at 2009 women, over 2,000 women, 976 men. They were ages 18 to 55, and that's young in medical terms. And they were admitted to the hospital for an acute heart attack in over 100 U.S. hospitals participating in this big study. And they said, well, they went in, and after, obviously, they had treated the patients and gotten their heart attack stabilized and so forth, they gave them this big multi-question interview, and this is what they found. The majority of women, 87% of all women, and 89.5% of all men had chest pain as the symptom of their heart attack. Now, this is a pressure, a tight feeling. Sometimes when patients describe it, they use a closed fist and hold that over their chest, or a discomfort. A lot of times I'll ask, so tell me about your chest pain. And they'll say, well, it's not really a pain. It's something that they don't describe as a pain, but it is an unusual feeling in the chest. Now, women were more likely to present with over 3 associated symptoms than men. That is, men say, look, I'm having a feeling in my chest, a discomfort in my chest. It's probably nothing. Women, meanwhile, 87% have this pressure or tightness, and also some stomach symptoms like a nausea or a stomach pain, heart palpitations, and pain or discomfort in the jaw, neck, arms, or between the shoulder blades. That is, the pain is more regional, going to the jaw, the neck, the arms, the shoulder blades, plus the chest, rather than being localized to the chest. 61.9% of women have one of those three symptoms, 54.8% of men. Not a lot, but still a significant difference between men and women. Women who had a heart attack that you could see on the EKG, 50% more likely to present without chest pain. I feel funny. My arm is numb. I got nauseated, and I haven't had anything to eat. I just all of a sudden got very nauseated and sweaty. They come in. We run the EKG. There's the heart attack, but there was not an actual chest pain. Women more likely to perceive symptoms as stress or anxiety. That's 20% versus 11%. Less likely to perceive them as muscle pain, 15% versus 21%. So your typical man comes in and says, I've hurt my chest. I've got a muscle pain in my chest. And the doctors believe them. Doctors absolutely believe them. Whereas the women come in and said, I don't know. I guess I'm just nervous. I've got some uncomfortable feelings in my chest, my arm, my shoulder, my epigastric area. And the doctors say, well, no, you just need to calm down.
We women hear that a lot.
Yeah, and no one ever calms down when you tell them to calm down. I mean, that's almost a guaranteed way to rile somebody up to tell them to calm down. But that is our sponsor. We'll go over it again in our second fractional portion. Heart attacks in women, your beating heart will make you weep, says Hank Williams. First article, and this is they're rapidly becoming regular contributors to Health Matters, BMJ Case Reports. Again, this is the old British medical journal, and they do case reports. February 12th, the 28-year-old man, he had, I mean, this guy has problem after problem. He is a triathlete, and he had what's called a sympathectomy. They did not take out his sympathy. He still had sympathy, but they took out his sympathetic nerves. These are the nerves that make your skin flush or make you sweat or make your hair stand on end. He had this facial flushing, and he could not get rid of it, so they cut the nerves that make your face flush. I'm occasionally embarrassed, but I'm not going to get surgery for it.
He must have been embarrassed a lot.
What exactly would you get surgery for?
Ruptured appendix. Pretty much.
You know? Isn't that a matter of dying versus getting surgery?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, the nose stays. I mean, it's not my favorite nose by any stretch, but I'm going to hang on
to
it.
What is your favorite nose?
Well, I'm looking at the Michael Jackson model, and I'm thinking,
which one?
No.
Yeah.
And He had two.
Yeah, as far as the love handles, you know, they're handily, I guess. Tony, I'm not going to do any of that.
Don't go there.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. No. Just not going to do that.
Okay, you win. I'm going to stop asking questions.
So his face flushes this brilliant red, and he gets the nerves to his face cut, and it works. He no longer flushes. Yay for him. But the problem is, postoperatively, he has this severe nerve pain. When they cut these nerves, it sort of damaged the nerves next to him, and he's got this nerve pain, and the sympathetic nervous system was in his thorax, that is in his chest cage. Those nerves go up to the face. They were cut, but now he's got this very bad pain in his chest, and it hurts when he moves, hurts when he moves his arms and so forth. He goes through physical therapy. He takes narcotic pain medicines, non-narcotic pain medicines. Nothing helps, and he is 10 weeks after surgery. He's getting no benefit. As I mentioned, he was a triathlete. And he said, you know, maybe if I went swimming, I wouldn't think about my pain. Problem was, it was winter. The water temperature was 51.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's cold.
That is cold water. Obviously not freezing. But so this was not the polar bear type plunge, but this was pretty bad. He jumps off a rocky outcropping into the water, 51 degrees, and according to the case report, forced to swim for about a minute.
Forced.
I mean, he jumped in the water off a rocky outcropping. You know you're not just going to jump back up on a rocky outcropping. That doesn't happen with rocky outcroppings.
So at 51 degree, you know, water temperature, you could hope.
Men do extraordinary things in 51 degree water. So he swims around the rocky outcropping, and he gets out. And first of all, it didn't hurt while he was swimming. And second of all, and this is key, it didn't hurt when he got out. In fact, his pain was cured by jumping into 51.8 degree Fahrenheit water and swimming around the rocky outcropping. That cured his pain.
Interesting.
Right. So, you know, of course, right away, this rocky outcropping is now a medically significant site. People are lined up on the rocky outcropping to jump in the water, except the temperature is too warm now, or I don't know. You know, it could be that. I guess not. But this is something called anecdotal evidence. You know, this happened. Now, it does not mean that we need to line people up and shove them in the water for aches and pains of various types.
That would be fun, though.
It's tempting.
I have to admit, you're right. It would be fun.
Well, what you do is you show them the article and then you push. And, you know, perhaps if you're having severe pain, ice water, or you don't have to get to ice water. You have to get to 51.8 degrees Fahrenheit water. But maybe some immersing in cool water and exerting yourself vigorously may help. But probably not. I mean, anecdotal reports are that way. Something happened to this guy's pain. And it went away, and I have no idea what it was, but that's an anecdotal report.
But we don't know that it won't come back or
we
hasn't
don't.
Come back.
And we certainly, you know, as a doctor, I might mention it to a patient, but I'm not going to start treating people with rocky outcroppings. I mean, it's just that's just not the way medicine works. We need to see a large number of people with different types of pain jumping off rocky outcroppings. And then if a significant number of them and somebody who assesses them doesn't know whether they've been to a rocky outcropping or not. And so, you know, eventually you have then a scientific trial where everything is systematic, everything is standardized, and you can see whether rocky outcroppings are, in fact, good for pain. Right now, it's a story. It's a great story. Good for him. But an anecdotal report does not change medical science. More on that in our second fractional portion. But his pain was cured, according to the BMJ case report, by jumping into 51.8 degrees Fahrenheit water. Now, the second thing, second type of study is, of course, are observational studies or questionnaire studies and so forth. And this was one from the American Thoracic Society's American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, published February 18th. This was one I told Shelley I was ready to apologize to a large number of patients who saw me in the clinic many, many years ago.
But then you thought twice about it?
I did, because I read the article.
You in the water.
Pushed me off the outcropping. This was talking, and you may have heard this one in the news.
I probably didn't.
Regular use of cleaning sprays has a adverse effects on your lungs, possibly as much as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, according to this study.
There's a lot of jokes here. They'll get me in so much trouble.
Okay. So you leave it on. But here's what happened. They took 6,000 people with an average age of 34 at the time they enrolled in the study who used cleaning products over a period of 2 decades. Then they measured.
Are they married? Because I think that matters here.
Okay. Some married, some single, women using cleaning products.
Well, guys too. I mean, you know, guys probably don't really start cleaning until they get married.
There were 6,000 people, but there were, the way they put it, there were so few guys using cleaning products. It was, they could not study them. So there was a guy there. He said he'd been swimming. 6, I don't know.
6,000. The ratio was 5,999 to 1.
Yeah,
absolutely
one man.
Right. So these people used these cleaning products, and they gave them a questionnaire. This is where we're going to leave it. What happened? Well, you could go read the report online or wait for us to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and we'd like to discuss marijuana with you. That's
weed,
the name of our show.
Weed.
In case
weed.
You didn't get that
weed.
Suddenly, we're going to just sledgehammer this thing to you.
Because you're so subtle, Tony. Really, we have to get past the subtle nature.
Our sponsor for the second time, Heart Attacks in Women, according to Hank Williams, your beating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your beating heart will tell on you. That's right. Your beating heart will make you weep. These are the symptoms of heart attacks, and they are different in men and women. The journal Circulation, February 19th, published the difference between men and women on their symptoms of heart attack. First of all, a lot of people had chest pain. 87% of women, 89.5% of men have that. However, the pain in women is often accompanied by symptoms in the pit of their stomach. This could be nausea or it could be a pain in the stomach. heart palpitations, where the heart seems to jump or beat irregularly, and a pain in the pain or discomfort in the jaw, neck, arms, or between the shoulder blades. It's more of a diffuse pain, not quite as well localized. 62% of women, 61.9% of women, had those other areas, only 54.8% of men, and that was significantly different. Women with a heart attack that shows up on the EKG, 50% more likely to present without chest pain. And again, we talked about that. Sudden onset of nausea, cold sweat, drenched in sweating, or shortness of breath, or those symptoms somewhere else. A woman comes in with that, you run the EKG, and there it is, heart attack clearly seen on the EKG. If you have a heart attack on your EKG, women are 50% more likely than men to present without any chest pain. Women more likely to perceive the symptoms as stress or anxiety. Men more likely muscle pain, because men don't have stress and anxiety, as we all know.
Apparently not.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
just,
because we ladies have it all.
We're too busy cleaning.
And it's from the cleaning that we do.
Women worry about cleaning. No, I'm not going. I'm sorry. I'm going to just shut that one down.
Hey, Tony. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. After 15 years, some restraint. 53% of women reported that their provider did not think that their anxiety was heart-related, whereas 37% of men found that their provider did not think that their muscle pain was heart-related. So again, the anxiety-type symptoms, as women interpret it, or as it is interpreted, I won't say the women interpret it, the providers interpret it, they say this is not important. Meanwhile, a man who comes in with a muscle pain, most of the providers will think that. And part of it, to be fair, men don't do well with symptoms. If a man comes in with any symptom between the neck and the navel, honestly, you look for a heart attack. I mean, it could be a choir feeling, it could be a twitching, it could be, you know, all sorts of things. But if it's in the chestular area,
chestular,
yeah,
I like that.
we are done. We need to get an EKG. Whereas a woman comes in and has some vague symptoms in the shoulder blades, maybe no chest pain at all, maybe a sensation in the epigastrium that is a stomach type symptom, and maybe it's anxiety. Kind of relates a story of anxiety, then that's tougher, but we've got to pay attention to that as well. That's pretty clear. So that's our sponsor, the heart attack symptoms in women. Now, we were talking about cleaning and asthma, and we've got 6,000 people, 5,999 women and one man. That's not the way it was, but it's close. Well,
the man was just confused. He walked in the wrong room.
It's not 50-50.
No, it's certainly not 50-50. And as I mentioned, truthfully, they did not have enough male participants to judge whether or not cleaning solutions have any effect. So they asked them, they said, all right, the first question, and I looked at this, this was a 28-page questionnaire. First symptoms, do your lungs wheeze or whistle? Do you feel shortness of breath? Do you have difficulty catching your breath in the exercise? All those things. They were basically looking for symptoms of asthma or lung disease. They did measure lung function. And if you've ever had a lung function test, you basically they put a tube, you seal your lips around a tube and you blow out as hard as you can. And we measure how much air you can hold in your chest and how quickly you can get rid of it. The how quickly you can get rid of it is called the FEV1, the expiratory volume in 1 second. So in 1 second, most of us can empty our chest. If you are wheezing, it will take you a lot longer. And that's how we tell who has asthma or who has emphysema. So the people that had the bad FEV1s, they said, well, have you been exposed to cleaning products, spray products, and so forth? And they define them as either not cleaning, or greater than one cleaning spray greater than once a week, or greater than one other cleaning product greater than once a week. So if you use spray cleaning products, you are more likely to have bad lung function. I mean, that's the crux of the study. That's the nuts and the bolts of the study. Decreased lung capacity, and again, the levels similar to smoking. Now, my problem with this study is something called recall bias, because remember I told you about those women. Many of them smoked, but they all mentioned that they were exposed to cleaning sprays when they were cleaning the house, or some of them were doing janitorial work and were exposed to cleaning sprays. If you have bad lung function, you search your memory for what might have caused it, and you remember those sprays.
Now, you're not going to remember the bad habit that you engage in.
No, many here in Eastern Kentucky, many of them smoked, and I thought that was the principal cause. Now, I am not saying that cleaning sprays are safe. I'm just simply saying when you ask this question, you're going to get that recall bias. My lungs are bad. I bet you there was something in the air. What was in the air? Those sprays. That's what it was. And so you work backwards. Whereas if your lung function's normal, you say, well, I don't think I really sprayed all that much. I don't think so. Now, the message you get from this, first of all, let's not take any chances. Stop spraying stuff to kill germs and stop spraying toxic chemicals in your bathrooms and bedrooms. Just stop that. That doesn't make any sense. They mention what you should do is just use water and wipes, microfiber cloths and water. You know, or at the very least, don't spray stuff through the air. But there is, you know, those things, those aerosols that you spray throughout your house, you know, whether they're disinfectants or whether they make the pleasant, the natural pine scent. They're all
you have that all. You have that by just opening the window, don't you?
Well, I will say this: I do not have it by a chemical spray, and I have treated one of my coworkers who had one of those things that whiffed the room every 30 seconds or something, was getting migraines. And so, no, don't put stuff in the air. As much as you can avoid chemicals in the air, it makes sense. So killing 99.9% of the germs in your kitchen accomplishes absolutely nothing. Meanwhile, you are hurting your lungs. Now, but I am not ready to say that this study conclusively proves that it's as damaging as a 20 cigarettes a day habit. No, I don't think so because of that recall bias thing. I'm not buying that. It's going to be tough to convince me on that.
Don't you mean you're not cleaning that?
Rick, you're not being very helpful. I mean, at times...
I'm never helpful.
No, I know, but at times...
So you're actually wanting me to be different.
Yeah, you're like you're like... I don't know what you're like.
Do you know what the clinical definition of insanity is? One of us is insane and it's not me.
Yeah, okay. Just doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Do you like that?
Yeah.
It's not really clinical, but I've heard it attributed to Einstein. I don't really know. For me...
It's relevant.
It is relevant. All right. You were going for relativity? I don't know. All right, let's keep moving.
There's nothing more fun than having you flustered.
I know, because you're grinding the show to a halt. All
the right. Show's not halted.
Speaking
it's going
of
on.
Grinding, this is Secretary of State Grimes proposed. It's close. Let me
grinding
give me a little leeway
Grime.
Here.
Oh, my goodness. Tony.
And the Medical Marijuana Task Force announced legislation back in January. This was House Bill 166, which would legalize medical marijuana use for a variety of illnesses. Grimes was excited about it. What started as a whisper years ago is now a loud chorus. Kentuckians have declared 2018 is the year they expect action on medical marijuana from their legislators. Now, you might ask yourself, well, what's in House Bill 166?
What is in House Bill 166?
Well, it creates new sections in the Kentucky Regulatory Statutes chapter to define terms like medical cannabis, certain patients with qualifying debilitating conditions, establish requirements for cultivation, processing, distribution, and sale in what they call compassion centers. Now, keep in mind, you cannot sell medical marijuana, any type of marijuana, in a pharmacy because it is illegal, federally illegal. So pharmacies would lose their license for selling it. So you got to sell it somewhere else, and they're going to sell it in what they call compassion centers. They're going to establish professional protections for practitioners, protections for cardholders, protections and responsibilities, restrictions on possession while operating a motor vehicle, qualifying events require the patients to get access to medical marijuana. Nothing in the bill, the bill says, we clarify, nothing in this bill requires government programs or private insurers to reimburse for costs of use or prohibits an employer from discipline an employee for workplace impairment. So if your drug test positive, and if this bill passes and you drug test positive and they've followed this bill is not amended, then you can drug test positive. You're subject to being fired.
Mm-hmm. How are you supposed to get it home?
The bill doesn't tell you how to get it home.
Because didn't it say something about possession?
While operating. They do have responsibilities and protection, so you assume you'd be able to get it home. They're going to have established a cannabis enforcement program by the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control to enforce the department's duties. They requirements for licenses, facilities, securities, transportation, so forth. And this is word for word. It's not that I'm skimming over all the things that it does. It just says, we need to do this. These are the things we need to do. That's the bill. We're going to require licensure and issuance of cards for medical cannabis businesses, licensure and application fees, department-issue registry cards, establish technical requirements for the cards, require 60% of the boards of medical cannabis businesses to be composed of individuals with 3 years Kentucky residence, three tiers of business regulation by gross receipts, protections and responsibilities for their compassion centers, the cultivators, procedures for departments to suspend or revoke registration, and so forth, and ballot initiatives. They're going to establish a 19-member oversight committee to advise the department and require the annual report to be sent, clarify the department's duties are administrative in nature, excise taxes of 10% for cultivators, excise taxes of 5% for processors or producers, and excise taxes of 5% for a distributor. 80% of the revenues go to administration of the Medical Cannabis Trust Fund for the enforcement project. So, and the other 20% go to local Medical Cannabis Trust Fund for enforcement of medical cannabis laws and licensing, hiring, and so forth. So it will, I think there is an idea that, you know, they bring the tax revenues come in. But they do the enforcement and so forth. Now, as a practical matter, how does this work? How do you get so-called medical marijuana? Well, you'd be pleased. I went online to High Times, not a site, I promise you, I have ever visited before in my life. But there it is. I went to High Times. And they described how in California, which does medical marijuana, they described how you get your card. I said, first of all, you can try asking your primary physician if cannabis is right for you and to write you a recommendation, but most people just opt for an evaluation by a cannabis specialist, a medical marijuana doctor. There are 420 medical marijuana doctors in the state of California, but many of them are in hard-to-reach places and some in sketchy neighborhoods. It's just, you know, most of us did not go to medical school to be a marijuana doctor.
Really?
Yeah. But there is an online way to get your medical marijuana card. $39. You fill out an evaluation form, standard medical form, upload that, the evaluation, a few minutes, and a phone conversation about your current condition, your history, and how marijuana might help you. If you do those things and pay $39, you can get a marijuana buyer's card. And that enables you to buy marijuana.
Buy it to produce it or buy it to use it?
Buy it to use it.
Buy it to use it. Okay.
Yeah. So you see a marijuana doctor, or you can go online and upload your history, and you get a buyer's card. Now, the buyer's card allows you to buy marijuana, and they may set limits and so forth. But the idea, I think, that many people have of, you know, your primary care physician watching and monitoring your blood pressure and treating your cholesterol is going to also oversee your marijuana. It's not true.
So you're not going to go get a prescription and take it to this compassion center?
No. You get a buyer's card by explaining. You have a qualifying condition.
So at that point, you can, again, whatever the limits are, you get to buy a certain amount.
That's correct. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily all smoked marijuana. There are, you know, there are lozenges. There are other forms of marijuana that you can buy. But in terms of regulation, you know, the regulation is really on the production, on the sale, and so forth. I want to make sure that our radio fans understand. And by the way, if you're not from Kentucky, I apologize. I know probably less about this than you do. But for people in Kentucky, particularly in rural Kentucky, this is a new idea, and I want them to understand this is not something that is going to be coming from pharmacies and hospitals. It's not going to be coming in regulated doses that tell you how many times a day to take it and so forth. It is something that you have a qualifying condition, and then you purchase the marijuana that you feel you need based on that.
So and it will come in a smokable form because, like, we haven't learned our lesson with tobacco.
Right. And keep in mind Weaver's Rule. Thanks for reminding me. Anything you set fire to and put in your mouth is going to have some significant side effects. That's part of it. But it could be, you know, again, you can get lozenges, you can get baked products or so forth. Bakery products, I guess baked is probably what you get, and the bakery product is what the marijuana comes
you,
in.
Yeah.
But at any rate, you can get those things as well. So there's several ways to get it once you have your buyer's card. But however you get it, you get it, and you determine the frequency within the buying limits. You determine the amount, and you determine the timing.
Doesn't this sound like the step that you put in before you just legalize it in the state?
Yeah, to be honest,
it feels that way.
I mean, as a physician, first of all, I think this is not the way. You know, this is not the way we treat patients.
Is this a pharmaceutical? If it is, let's treat it like a pharmaceutical.
Yeah. So it's not. And I will tell you, just as a physician, I think the decision here is, do we want to have recreational marijuana? And you can run all this through the buyer's cards and all this regulatory stuff. But honestly, I would say just either legalize it or don't legalize it. I would not go through this step personally. But I did want people to understand. I think this is correct. Again, my information comes from High Times as far as the card goes. My understanding from talking to physicians and reading literature from states that have legalized, this is the way that works. My only point here is not that it's right, not that it's wrong. You make up your mind on that. My point is, it's not really not medical.
But they're setting up the purchase of it is not really medical, right? I mean, name one other thing you go to the doctor to get a buying permit for.
Yeah, it would be entirely different than. And the other thing is, you know, you can go to Canada and get it recreationally. You can go to several states and again get it recreationally there. So, you know, it's you think about that. That's also not the way, say, with your blood pressure medicines. You go to another state and they're over the counter. It doesn't work that way. So against this backdrop, then, we have legislation that instructs the state to create this network that will allow the distribution of medical marijuana. Into that comes the Rowan Fiscal Court, which had a meeting and had a really pretty nice debate about marijuana in general. And then they made a motion to support the House Bill 166, and it died due to lack of second. So there was not strong enthusiasm on the Rowan County Fiscal Court for doing this, and several members asked why are we doing this in the first place. That's where we left it. Now, a couple of things I want to mention. In the debate, someone mentioned about the National Academy of Sciences. They did a study showing that marijuana was more effective than placebo. National Academy of Sciences really doesn't do studies. It is a group of scientists. They do issue expert reports, and they're working on an expert report indicating the benefits, the risk of marijuana. That is not complete at the time we went to press, and so there may have been a study from somewhere else on their website, but they, in fact, do not do research. It's an academy of scientists who are stationed all across the country at universities, and this is an umbrella organization, but itself, it does not do that. The science is very, very minimal. And I will explain that when we come back in our third fractional portion. And that's very frustrating. You know, people say, well, here was this study that looked at it, say, for seizures, or here was a study for chronic pain, or here's a study in veterans. Those studies, it turns out, are not terribly scientific studies. We'll come back and explain more about this in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and this is the We'd Like to Discuss Marijuana Show. Our sponsor for the final time, Heart Attacks in Women, reminding you from Hank Williams, your beating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your beating heart will tell on you. That's right, there are symptoms of a heart attack, and they are slightly different in women and men, according to the journal Circulation, February 19th, 2018. Everybody, or the majority of people, not everybody, but the majority of people, feel chest pain, pressure, tightness, an uncomfortable feeling in their chest. 87% of women, 89.5% of men feel that. Women also feel other symptoms. They're about 7% more likely to feel other symptoms, and that is epigastric symptoms in the kind of in the pit of the stomach, a nauseated, queasy feeling, or even some pain there. Heart palpitations, where their heart is jumping and not beating regularly. Pain or discomfort in the jaw, neck, arms, or between the shoulder blades. It's a more diffuse then presentation with women than in men. Women are also more likely, 50% more likely than men, to present without any chest pain and yet have an obvious heart attack on their EKG. And then finally, women more likely to perceive symptoms as stress or anxiety. Men more likely to perceive them as muscle pain. And the healthcare professionals seem to be more worried about the men. Their symptoms were heart-related about 63% of the time, whereas women's heart-related symptoms were only 57% of the time felt to be related to their heart. So we keep that index of suspicion high. If you're a man and you get a muscle pain between your neck and your belly button, you should get to the emergency room. If you're a woman and you become anxious in the pit of your stomach and sweaty, you should get to the emergency room. And that is our recommendation. Please take these symptoms seriously, heart attacks in women. So when we left off last time, we were talking about science and marijuana use. And I mentioned, first of all, at the meeting there was a discussion from an article from the National Academy of Science, but they don't really do research. On the other hand, there is precious little research that has been done, and that's really strange. Most of the research comes in the form of anecdotal evidence, and that is like the man who jumped off the rocky outcropping in our first fractional portion. It worked. I mean, it absolutely worked. This was true. This was not false. This was not. This is not to be dismissed. But it also, it's, you can't legislate that rocky outcroppings be used for pain control. It would be silly.
Yeah, we can't generalize that to everybody.
No, but I absolutely believe that this man got pain relief. And so when I see that marijuana can be used to treat various conditions, everything from Parkinsonism to fibromyalgia and so forth, I believe it. I absolutely believe it, but I can't generalize from it. I cannot move that into population. The other thing that we've done, since we can't do research on marijuana, it is still, according to the DEA, it's called a Schedule 1, no known benefit and great harm. It's up there with LSD. It is like, it is very difficult to get your hands on research grade marijuana to really to prove anything. So what we do is we do observational studies on people who may be smoking or ingesting marijuana of varying potencies at varying amounts and metabolizing it at varying speeds. We have no idea what's in them, but we observe them. And some of them get relief, once again, just like the rocky outcropping guy. Mm-hmm. So an observational study may show that people who smoke marijuana are more likely to get relief from Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis or so forth. Remember, an observational study also shows that people with large shoes get to play professional basketball. I observe professional basketball players. They wear large shoes. Large shoes will get you in the NBA. But if I start strapping large shoes on half the people and small shoes on the other half, it's going to be pretty clear it has no relationship at all to whether you play professional basketball. So that's the problem with an observational study. It's still truth. An observational study is true. Those people did get relief or did see benefit. But until we split people into two groups and give half of them the marijuana and half of them don't get the marijuana, and we control that, we're not going to know for sure. And we are not allowed to do that because the darn DEA has this thing at Schedule 1. So as a scientist, as a medical person, I see this stuff getting away from any type of medical treatment, and we are not learning a thing about it. As a doctor, I do not know a thing that is, I feel comfortable, is scientifically proven about the health benefits of marijuana. I just don't, and that's very frustrating to me. I know anecdotal evidence, like the rocky outcropping. I know observational studies, like the big shoes. But I do not know what would happen if I started a person on marijuana. What would happen?
Or even the dose, you know,
right.
How much,
how often. How do we do it? That's
the problem. Smoke it, lozenge, you know, the way we get it into them, we just don't know.
Now, one of the things that came up in front of the physical court was, well, look, you doctors are not doing any good with your narcotics. You're killing people. And so we can do better than that. And let me say, you're probably right. I am really embarrassed as a physician by what we've done with opioids.
No, I mean, you know, we've talked about it on the show many times, yeah. Especially as folks get older.
Now let me offer a very, very wimpy defense. When this thing started, we were deluged with people saying, you've got to do something. There is such pain in the world. There are so many people suffering. You've got to take care of their pains. And in comes the drug company. Hey, we can do it. And we've got some medicine here. It's really not addictive. They said that. It's really not addictive. And really, the side effects are minimal. These new narcotic pain medicines are really something. Minimal side effects. They're really not addictive. That's what we were told. And so when you come in with marijuana and you say, it's really not addictive and it really has less side effects, I'm going, oh, my gosh, I've heard that before. And for me, that is probably the worst argument in favor of marijuana, because that's what kills 1,000 Kentuckians a year, is those darn opioids. And I will freely confess, the doctors played a big role in starting that. But we thought we were doing something good for people relieving their pain.
And you were told by pharmaceutical companies who did drug research, randomized controlled trials, that good research, so to speak.
Yeah.
We don't even have that for marijuana yet.
No, it's not a very good endorsement of that type of research. But yeah, the drug companies could do it. Marijuana has not yet done it. But I do not feel, well, gee, you know, we've got to do something for these people. That's what we said when we got into all this trouble with opioids. So maybe it's better. I will freely confess on this show, marijuana may be a good thing, but I see it as another drug. And I will challenge anybody to go throughout the history of civilization and find where civilization was saved by mind-altering drugs and life was improved. I mean, if it is such a drug as is described, it is the first in the history of mankind.
There has been a nationwide kind of movement towards this legalization for recreational use, and it just seems like everything has that in mind. And so you hate to see the medicine side of this just get thrown out, but I mean, it doesn't. This, who knows?
Yeah, it's a mind-altering drug. It has apparently a lower addiction, and certainly it is a safer mind-altering drug than opioids. But for me, that comparing it to opioids, to narcotic pain medicines, is not a good comparison. I hate them. They kill. I mean, you take any drug that kills 1,000 Kentuckians a year, it needs to be off the market. Mm-hmm. Whatever benefits, you're killing 1,000 people a year. I mean, what? How can you possibly have, even if we were to cure the plague with this stuff, if it costs 1,000 people a year, that's still not, I don't think that's, I would never accept that risk. So it is safer than narcotics, okay? I'll concede that, even though I don't have really strong science on that. There are possible benefits, but I don't know what they are. And I will tell you, if you look for facts on marijuana, please do not Google. At the very least, there's something called Google Scholar. You can at least get to some minimal research. But I'll be honest, before this fiscal court meeting, and I felt like I needed to tell you about the buyer's cards and so forth, I would never put this on the air because the science is not strong enough to merit us talking about it. But I feel like, well, we're about to look at the possibility of medical marijuana. I at least need to tell you how that works. And to go on record as saying, as a physician, I'm not interested in more mind-altering drugs of any type. That is our summary on marijuana. We appreciate your time while we preached at you. And I would recommend the DEA, please change this. Let us get to the point where we can do some research, because it's pretty clear, or just forget it. You know, we're going to wind up watching this thing become recreational, and then we'll deal with the fallout. I will remind you, in World War I, the Red Cross was sending millions of cigarettes to Europe because we need to support our military and help them to avoid the pain and horrors of war. So when people talk about our military veterans needing it for PTSD, that's exactly how we started with tobacco. So the medical guy in me sees these things going, sees the cycle starting again, and I'm thinking, all right, how badly are we going to be fighting marijuana in the mid-21st century? We will stay tuned. Hopefully I'm wrong. I'll put it that way. One final thing. May 2017, almost a year ago, in health affairs, medical marijuana laws were associated. These are facts. With a decline in the number of prescriptions for Medicaid enrollees. There was a 13% reduction in drugs used to treat depression, 17% those drugs used to treat nausea, 12% reduction in those used to treat psychosis and seizure disorders, 11% reduction in drugs used to treat pain. So, and no difference in drugs for anxiety, glaucoma, sleep disorders, or spasticity. Spasticity, as a matter of fact, a trend toward increase. So, once again, it is a drug. There's no doubt about that. it could be beneficial. I don't think it matters. I think it will become recreational, and at that point, we will deal with whatever toxicities we see. FDA has a website on marijuana. I love this. They answer all these questions about whether it could be sold as a dietary supplement and so forth. And then the last question, what should I – I've seen it marketed for pets. Are they safe? Question 20, I gave my pet marijuana. Can I give my pet marijuana? And then 21 was, I gave it marijuana, and now it's having adverse effects. What should I do? So, this in no way is editorial.
Apparently, the FDA needs to speed up their response time to the questions.
Well, you just wonder exactly.
Patience got the best of him there.
Yeah, I got to say, things are not looking good for the dog. Next up, so money can't buy happiness, but poverty can buy depression. This is Deborah Brody. This was National Center for Health Statistics data brief. Around 8% of U.S. adults have a depression, women twice as likely as men. And they were looking from 2013 to 2016. 10.4% of women ages 20 years and older had depression. Now, what they did was they gave them a survey, and they did a screening survey for depression. So they asked them questions that we use to screen for depression. The people who answered in such a way that they would be diagnosed with depression in this national survey, they were defined as having depression. Now, here's the thing that really – a couple of things. Among both men and women, the percent with depression has not differed statistically across age groups. That is, young people not more likely than old people or vice versa. It's not changed much during the past decade, which I found to be interesting, going from Republican to Democratic to back to Republican rule, no change in depression. The prevalence of depression among men and women decreased with increasing family income. If your family is below the federal poverty level, your risk of depression, if you're an adult, 15.8% of them had depression by this screening exam. If you are at or above 400% of the federal poverty level, 3.5%. So as you go from poverty to 400% or greater of poverty, basically wealth, your risk of depression as an adult drops from 15.8% to 3.5%.
That's pretty impressive.
It is pretty depressive, or antidepressive, I guess. So you could take, once again, you could take medicines, you could smoke your marijuana, or you can get rich. What you need to do, this is Health Matters, strong recommendation, you should get rich. You should be rich as much as you can.
So sell marijuana and get more money, and you'll be happy, right?
So what you're saying is they need both a buyer card and a seller card.
I don't know. You guys just took that a little bit too specific for me. I am not – well, I don't think I can –
You teed it up.
I know, but I don't think we can make that recommendation. I'm not sure that we'll be able to leave the studio after that.
That's true. You are kind of responsible for our recommendations, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm not the pusher man here. You know, we're not recommending use of illegal drugs on this show, but we are recommending get some money, because this is just, I mean, the graph very clearly, they traced it from below federal poverty to 100 to 200% to 200 to 300% to greater than 400%, and it drops at every income level, lower rates of clinical depression. And clinical depression, this is something where you cannot sleep, you're gaining or losing weight, it either hurts to move or you just can't quite find a place. There's sort of pain associated with it. No pleasure in anything. You quit your hobbies. Your job performance suffers. Your interest in loved ones drops. And obviously, at its most severe, you start considering whether or not you should continue living. That is what we're talking about, clinical depression. Now, they're not talking about suicides. No, they're not doing that. But they are talking about clinical depression. And it becomes almost five times as likely as your income drops. I honestly don't know what to make of that.
I don't either. I would like to know more details about the.
Well, I went back to see how they. I thought, did they just go self-reported? And the answer is no. I mean, they used a screening test that we would use in a doctor's office to diagnose depression. Rick, I'm going to stop there.
Why are you going to do that? You just had it, you're depressed?
Yeah, I am.
We can't stop on a high note. You know this.
Yeah, right. All right. So you want me to?
Yeah, let's get us off the air, Rick.
Fast as possible?
Yeah.
Okay. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember these important facts about Health Matters, medical health matters.
A report published in 2016 found that health matters related crime had increased in Washington State after our program was legalized. There was a rise in the possession of illegal health matters, most of which was being sent to states where our show is still not legal.
However, those reports represent only a small portion of one state. Overall crime statistics for Washington were down 10%, and the murder rate dropped 13%. Colorado also saw decreases in overall crime rates and violent crimes after Health Matters was legalized.
And pizza sales went up. Colorado saw an increase of 14% in traffic incidents after Health Matters was legalized. Researchers estimated that 2.7% of that rise was due to our show.
However, reports emphasize that while more drivers in Washington and Colorado admitted to listening to Health Matters while operating their vehicle, there was very limited data before our show was legalized.
A poll of high school students showed a slight drop in listening to Health Matters after we became legal. Similar decreases were noted in Colorado, usually 1 to 2%.
However, since legalization, Health Matters use in Colorado by young people is the highest in the nation, 74% higher than the national average.
However you interpret your statistics, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.